Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.
Welcome to another episode of the El Arpa podcast. This is Mary, and today we have a very special edition. We have an interview with Robbie Don, who works for us, the sports newspaper here in Spain. And usually we make the joke that this is hashtag not a football podcast. And in this case, it's not just a football podcast, because we'll be talking about football, but also about many other interesting topics for us, such as immigration, writing, and, well, just see for yourself. We leave you with it. See you in part three.
So here we are in our podcast interview. We have Robbie Dunn, an Irishman from Kildare, an author of Working Class Heroes, the story of Rayo Vallecano in Madrid, and you've been very kind to come and talk with me and Mary today. So Robbie, how are you? How's it going?
Great. Thanks a lot for having me. It's no problem at all joining you.
Ah, sound man. Thanks very much. So first of all, before we jump into the football, you and I have something in common, of course. We're both Irish lads living in Madrid. So for like, what was the pull for you? Why did you come here?
Yeah, so my girlfriend is from Madrid. She lives, her family's from originally Canillejas, and they live in Barajas now. So when we met in Ireland, she's going to listen to this podcast, and I don't know. I think it was like 6 years ago now. And we lived in Ireland for a couple of years together. The plan was always to move to Madrid. I don't know if you've noticed this, but Spanish people are very proud of where they're from and stuff, I guess, like all of us. But Andrea was always like really set on moving back to Madrid, and she'd always tell me, oh, how great it is living there in the summers and things you can do there. It's such a great lifestyle and things like that. And she loved Ireland as well, but the plan was always to move over here. I was studying, so I had lived in America for a while, and I came home and I went back to college, studied journalism, and then by the time I finished, we were ready to go, and Andrea just moved here, and she had actually found us an apartment, and I came and joined her then, and the rest is history.
Okay, that's a very good reason to come here.
Yeah.
The reason I came here is because it was the tail end of the recession, all the people were leaving Ireland anyway, so I have a less romantic, more depressing economic reality reason for being here, but such is fate. But and your girlfriend you mentioned is Spanish, and yourself, you obviously can see both worlds as well. Yeah. Do you think there's a lot of similarities between the two countries?
Yeah, I guess there isn't. I mean, there isn't. I'm the kind of person who look at stuff really, I don't know, like an almost like an atomic level, and I'd attach meanings to things, and I'd see it, and I'd be trying to kind of explain to my girlfriend about how I see, like, because I'm from the country as well, so I grew up in a small community, and even moving into a city, whether that's in Spain or Germany or America, it's slightly different. So I guess I attach a lot of meaning to that, and I say Spain when it could be any city, in that, like, I don't know, people are more kind of into their own things. Like, whereas when I grew up in a community, and it was way more way smaller and I guess just a small town, and so in that sense it's completely different for me. But a lot of the things, like, I mean Spanish people and how close they are to their families and things like that, that strikes me as something very similar to what I would be used to back home and things like that. But for all the similarities, there's just as many differences in terms of in terms of sport, which is another reason why I came here. Like, I mean, obviously we have GAA and the League of Ireland is starting to really pick up now, from what I can see on the outside. But here you've got, I mean, they're just absolutely sports mad. You've got every day of the week almost you can go and see a game. You have La Liga, Real Madrid, like an institution, you can go and see them playing basketball. You've got that whole rivalry between Barcelona and Real Madrid, and obviously then the summers is completely different, something that I'm just not used to whatsoever in terms of planning ahead. Like, we aren't kind of sure when we're going to, you have to go abroad to in order to have a vacation or a holiday, whereas here you can drive down to Valencia for, it's a couple of hours away, and all of a sudden you're in the beach and we go down to Malaga or things like that. And for me, that's one of the biggest differences as well.
The sporting thing is an interesting comparison, because you're right, you can see world class basketball, world class football, and soon we'll be talking about Rayo Vallecano. What do you think about the idea that maybe, because Spain has a lot of advantages over Ireland, but maybe the sporting life in Ireland could be arguably richer because you have more things, like boxing, horse riding, as you mentioned, Liga as well, GAA. And in terms of, like, you know, you can see Munster, who are like the Rayo Vallecano maybe of rugby, but they have that Barrio neighbourhood support, but they're world class. And it's the same with the GAA, because, okay, it's world class in terms of their high level. Obviously, it's an exclusively Irish sport as well. So as a sporting fan, are there things that you miss from the sporting aspect of life in Ireland when you're here? Even though obviously it's very enriching to be here as well, talking about sports.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like, I mean, and there's so many differences then with the sporting media as well. Like, Ireland's so small in that, and then you've got the likes of like the second captains and off the ball and things like that. The sporting media is very rich, and they really dig deep down into the subject matter, and I find that fascinating. But also, the thing about living in Ireland is Ireland and sport. It's almost, we're underdogs and we never expect to win. So say if you get Ireland and the rugby team, that's huge. Like, we're a small, tiny country of 5 million people, and I understand that not that many countries participate in rugby, and it's not that as competitive maybe as soccer. But like, then you get Spain and they expect to win. Like the World Cup this year, or sorry, last year, I was like, Spain are going to win this, and I'm going to be in Spain when they win this. And I'm reading newspapers and I'm like, there's a very, and I obviously I'm not Spanish, I'm very, very much Irish still, but I feel a little bit Spanish given the fact that I live here and I work here, and my in-laws are from here. And I was like, we're going to win this, and it's incredible to think that. Whereas Ireland going to the World Cup is
kind of
like, and like Roy Keane was right in that. And then so you get the whole history of Spain as well then, and when I say they're very proud, I mean there's still kind of that maybe little bit of a nationalistic bent to everything, but there is this kind of pride in that, and I think that comes from the imperialism from hundreds of years ago, in that Spain were conquerors, whereas Ireland, we were the subjects. And I think that still pervades everyday life, and that Spain see themselves as trailblazers, and Ireland see ourselves as kind of the also-rans.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point, because you're right. It's very interesting what you say. We have experienced colonialism as the victims, and Spain would be a major European power that perpetrated it.
Yeah.
Sorry, Maria. and that does pervade Spanish life. When it comes to sport, it's okay, but in other areas of life, you can see kind of uglier applications of that. And it is very frustrating for me as an Irish person, because I think I do have a touch of that. I'm very proud to be Irish, and again, not in a better than anybody else kind of way, but it frustrates me greatly when I see the sensation of, well, we're just here to make up the numbers kind of thing, and that really annoys me. And speaking of supporting Spain or looking at Ireland, for example, you were the only Spanish person in the village when Spain were in the World Cup in 2008, because Mary's also an immigrant. Lived in England for a while in Newcastle. Loves Alan Shearer.
You were hoping football was coming home, were you?
What was it like? Because we never really spoke about this, actually, but you're the only Spanish person where you were and had the Spanish flag in the bar watching the matches. What was it like following Spain in that scenario?
It was a bit depressing, really, because, I mean, we won both, like, the World Cup and the European Cup, and I lived in a very small place, like near Newcastle, but a small place nonetheless. I just wanted to get out and celebrate and everything, but it wasn't like, I don't know, people thought I was crazy because I think it was a Sunday as well, and I was just like with a flag outside the window, and everybody was just looking at me like she's crazy or something. But it was fine. I met a couple of Spanish people in the bar, and then again, what you were saying, even for me, it's a bit frustrating because, for example, there, we even had a bit of a fight because about the flags, you know, they were saying, oh, why should Villa have the flag from Asturias and all this, and why should the Barça people have the... And I'm not bothered, like, I'm really happy for people to express, like, their local identities. So I think there's a bit of what you were saying, but I think there's also a lot of people I have to defend, some of us that are not necessarily, you know, just proud of, like, only the national identity, but also local identities too.
Absolutely,
so that was my experience.
I'd say though as well, like, what could be like interesting as well is, like, we talk about, like, Ireland's sporting legacy. It's always very dismissive in Spain. I think it's just like, well, what is it? What have you won? Well, as a football fan, I think, well, you only came good in 2008.
And Spain had a horrible track record of disappointment built up dreams that have come crashing down, but that's the other thing about, like, with the Spain flag out the window and things in England. I think Spain, there's also kind of a romantic side to it as well, in that everyone has been to Spain on holidays and has a kind of a nice image of it, and they also happen to play lovely football, and there's that kind of I don't know, it's like Mediterranean feel to it, like this whole, and I think that makes Spain more, a little bit more welcoming, they say, than say maybe Germany, and I understand that Germany and England have a history going back as well, but I think Spain, and maybe this is just me saying this, but I think Spain is a lot of people see the Spanish flag and see Spain football team and they've good associations with it, I think. So it's probably a little bit easier living abroad when Spain are doing well in that sense.
Well, also part of our blog and our podcast, we talk about the links between Ireland and Spain. So you just published an article on our blog recently about how two translators from where? Galicia.
Juan Ramón Jiménez.
Yeah.
And he's from the south of Spain. Well,
okay.
Yeah, he was arriving in the 20s.
And they translated, James Inge, the Irish playwright. About the Aran Islands and everything as well.
There's
a whole canon of Irish work that's been translated into Spanish as well. And some of the stuff did eventually influence Lorca as well. So part of what we do as well is just kind of explore the very, very deep links that people mightn't be aware of between Ireland and Spain, because we think that really we actually have a lot in common as two nations, and Spain's a wonderful place, of course. And now, as an Irish person, you mentioned you feel a little bit Spanish and all those things. Do you ever see yourself going back, or even, because I know people who've been here for 30, 40 years and they support Spain, they support Real Madrid, and they've practically lost their connection to Ireland. They still go back for Christmas with their family and things like that, but for all intents and purposes, they're Spanish. And as much as I love Spain, I can never visualize losing the Irish part of myself. And of course, there's no right or wrong answer, but what about, like, how do you see yourself plugging into this? And
To be honest with you, I'm not sure. I mean, like I said, the summers here alone would keep you here.
You get
4 months of good, solid, warm weather, and just planning for that. And given the nature of my job as well, I guess I do get to have a lot of downtime maybe during the summer, and you can work remotely and stuff like that. So I do get to go home quite often. So I never really lose that. But I mean, as I said, I lived in Chicago for 4 years, and I see people that have been there for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and they still have that little kind of a hint of an Irish accent. So, but I notice, especially when I'm speaking to Spanish people and people who aren't from Ireland, I tend to speak a little bit more clearly. But when I go home,
yeah,
I'm talking to my dad and my brother and that, I go straight back into this kind of thick Midlands accent that... Yeah,
well, when I come back, she's always giving out.
Yeah,
you've come back with your accents.
Yeah, exactly. So you never lose that. And I think, as I said in my book as well, and I feel really strongly about that, like, the way, those kind of things that you grow up with, obviously you can change and you can learn new things and stuff like that, but that identity that you have, it really does shape you, how you think and who you are, people you associate with, and things like that. That never leaves. So
yeah,
regardless of whether I think I'm Spanish or not, that'll always be there. And I felt that in when I was in Chicago, and I feel that now, when to be honest, it could be 10, 15, 20 years and I'd never lose that.
Okay, very interesting. Well, I've been trying to make her more Irish because we've been doing an Irish course online.
Ask where you go.
Yeah, ask where you go.
Yeah, nice one.
But I have to say, you're progressing more than I am.
Yeah.
I've put more hours
into it.
That's also true.
It's a sad thing in that like people that we don't speak Irish. I think it's absolutely...
You lose so much,
yeah,
when you lose your language. And what's also interesting is because in the article that Maria published, it was on the Aran Islands, and it was a play that was very much written in the style of the vernacular of that town, and then
yeah,
translated using Galician, not Galician, but Southern Spanish kind of
yeah,
idioms and phrases like that. And it kind of tells so much about the culture as well,
yeah,
not even just like an Irish culture, but like a specific culture in that country as well. So, but anyway, so enough grilling you about why you're here. So we'll talk to you about football as well. So you are a football journalist. You work for AS. I have experience before at Marca as well. So you cover Spanish football, of course. And as I mentioned in the intro, you've written a fantastic book about Rayo Vallecano called Working Class Heroes. One thing that really I love, because I saw this in an interview on YouTube, you said you wrote this book because you went into a bookstore and you're looking for a book that didn't exist, which is such a beautiful way of expressing that. Can you kind of describe more about the genesis of the idea and how it came about, even coming in contact with the publishers and things like that?
Yeah, coming into contact with the publishers, I'd be a very impulsive kind of person. So I remember like years ago, before I'd ever started writing, because I studied computing years ago when I went to college, and I was always creative, or had a creative mindset, but I just never really knew that I wanted to write. And I don't know, like I studied English in school and I was okay at it, and I liked it, had a good teacher, but never really saw it as an avenue. And it's something that kind of gets to me now, because it is an avenue, like, and that, I guess. And obviously I had to go through all these steps to Chicago and all that to eventually become a writer and see myself as some kind of a writer. But my mother said to me, maybe I think it was like 5 years ago, before I'd even written a word on a page, and she had said, "Oh, you're I think you're gonna write a book someday." We were laughing. We're like, "What are you on about, man? Like, what does that even mean? This is before," and she turns out she was right. Like, I don't know what it was that she saw, but I guess I was always fascinated by the creative process, I guess, even if it was something that was kind of subconscious for a long time. But in terms of that quote about going into a bookshop and finding a book that you want to, it was just, it wasn't like, as I said, I'm impulsive, so I wasn't doing it for any reason other than just to have a project, because I'm the kind of person that gets very, very bored, or not bored, but I need projects. And like, even back when I was 5 years of age, I remember I was bored in school because we weren't getting any homework and we weren't doing things and we weren't creating stuff.
Yeah.
And my mother says that to me still. She's like, "You were always the kind of person that needed projects and needed to be learning and things like that." And I guess that's where that came from. And then just, one of the guys, Ewan McTare, he had written a book about Ibar, and I wrote to him and said, "What was the process for doing a book, and he sent me what he did and how he did it and how it came to be, and I just fired them an email, and they were like, oh yeah, that's really interesting. And this is at a time when I hadn't got a clue about Rayo, like, and
yeah.
I knew about them and I knew about Spanish football and things like that, but I didn't know where it was, as I said in the book. I didn't know anything pretty much about Vallecas or anything like
yeah.
that. And then that's when, even a couple of months into the project, I was like, what am I doing here? You know,
yeah.
And like, it was only after about maybe 6, 7, 8 months of solid writing, thinking, researching, going to games, when I was like, okay, this is actually going to become a book here.
Yeah.
This is going to happen. Whereas before that, I was kind of like, I don't know. I guess it's really impulsive of me, but I that's just the way I am.
No, fair play, because, I mean, as I said, it's a fantastic book. You mentioned, like, in the book, the story is you're fresh off the boat, basically. You're green. Don't speak the language really either, and you plug into this very rich and vibrant community, and that's a credit to you. It's an amazing story in itself, your story in writing the story of Rayo Vallecano, and you know, even coming in not knowing much about it, as you said yourself, you weave together this story, which does take in the football, history, culture. You speak to historians, you put in other kind of sources that are not football but maybe more cultural. That's why Giles Tremlett comes in, for example,
yeah.
and other things like that. And it's a good skill to be able to do that, to kind of like put all these threads together and make this unified whole, which is sorry, I know you're Irish, so it's very hard to hear praise, maybe. but basically, it's a credit to you, you know?
Oh, no, thanks. Yeah, no. But that's actually what I was trying to go for, because it wasn't, I wasn't writing it from the point of view of an expert, because I wasn't one. And
yeah.
You can't fake that. So I was kind of like, okay, let's kind of go on this. This is a journey for me, so maybe someone reading it can think the same and go somehow go on the little kind of journey together.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I didn't know that, and I can tell by him writing this that he's learning that as well.
Yeah.
Because people I interviewed, like, they were experts in the subject, and I'd ask them questions that maybe they hadn't broached in a very long time or hadn't even really thought about, and they'd be like, yeah, I never really. I never thought about that, but yeah. And then they think it through, and they're like, that's a pure novice question that an expert doesn't think about, because it's a different way of thinking, I guess.
Yeah, but they were generous with their time, though, and they never said, oh, I mean, come on, that's a silly question or anything like that.
No, not at
all,
no. People just tend to be very, very nice.
The reason I mention that is because I've, like, done a lot of interviews as well, and most of the time it's been very positive as well. But once I remember, and I'll tell you who it is after the podcast. But that sensation is just like, well, don't ask me that. That's a stupid question. And it just really shuts down the exploration and everything as well. And also, what did I want to say? You mentioned as well that writing can be an avenue. And in our last podcast, we interviewed a guy called Gavin Greenaway, who's a composer. And we were commenting on how, like, the arts, like, in Ireland, for example, in the Leaving Cert, history has been taken off the senior cycle. It's not a core subject anymore. You can do it as a voluntary subject. And how a teacher in England, Gavin told us, said, like, what's the point of music? There's no point in studying artistic or creative things. But, you know, he said, you can get a job, you can earn a living, and also it's a very fundamental part of who we are. And based on what you said, I imagine you probably feel the same way, that these creative pursuits, not only can they make you gainfully employed, but also that they're important in many senses, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't actually know that. Yeah, my brother's a secondary school teacher at home, and I didn't know that. But yeah, like, that's the thing. And I guess it's something that I would, it's a kind of a gripe that I have with teaching and the educational system, in that you're not told that there are these possibilities. Like, because, as I said in the book, if you're like, and I really and truly think this, if you're passionate about something, you can find a way to do it. And I mean, I don't know, maybe it's not going to be a conventional route, it's not going to be linear, your wealth isn't going to, or your pay packet isn't going to rise in a linear fashion, maybe, and there's going to be downs, and there's going to be a struggle, and there's going to be setbacks. But if you're passionate, truly passionate about something, and want to learn about it, you can make it happen. Like, and I, like, it's something that I didn't get from my schooling experience, and it was tailored to a very, very set mindset, I guess, in that this kind of rote learning. And and innovation comes from a mixture between kind of that rote learning and critical thinking, and that mixture of the two, where you can mix 7 or 8 different disciplines and with a little bit of creativity, and when for example football and society, and when you can, when you know both of those things very well, and then you're sitting at home thinking about it, and you're like, okay, there's something in this, and that's where innovation happens. Like, and I just didn't get that from my schooling experience. Even when I went back to college, there was a very, very rote learning, and people were, the people who did the best in my class were capable of and obviously highly intelligent people too. Like, I'm not saying anything's wrong with that, and the world needs those kind of people, maybe even more so than me, the likes of me. But there is a different kind of thinking. There is a different kind of. And obviously that's, we know that there's different kind of learning, visual learners and things like that, but I just feel like, and I guess it's hard to distinguish it, like, between those kinds of people. And I guess in school I would have been seen as someone who was maybe very hyper, and I couldn't relax, couldn't sit down. And I went to as part of the GPA, I was playing with Kildare for 1 year, and the GPA, the Gaelic Players Association,
okay,
have absolutely brilliant setup for people who don't really know what they're doing. They've got different things like that. And I went to see a guidance counsellor, and I had to do like a Myers-Briggs test. And I had to write down all these questions and answer all these questions, and it's the kind of test where you can't really lie. It catches, not that you want to lie in one of those, but even if you're subconsciously lying, you don't know what you're saying, it catches these things. And I met him for a coffee in Maynooth, Fran was his name, and had a coffee, and he gave me this booklet about myself, and
wow.
And I was like reading this, and I was like, yes, that's what I need. And the areas that I'm weakest in, the areas that I'm strongest in, the kind of people that I get on with, the kind of people that I don't get along with, areas where I could work in, areas that probably wouldn't suit me, different things like that. And that alone, that book was kind of like a turning point for me. Like, it was maybe 30 pages or something, graphs and things like that. And I was reading it going, like, this is who I am. And I was told me more about myself than I had learned in 28 or 9 years prior to that.
That's incredible. It seems like a very progressive way of doing it, which I guess would be different from how it's traditionally been done. And I don't know, in Spain, is it similar? Because I had the same experience in Limerick as well. I mean, in Spain, growing up in Madrid, I mean, is it by rote? Is it passion killing?
I think here, by default, everything is focused on more on science.
Okay.
And I remember at school, I mean, like, well, I had pretty decent grades and I just wanted to do like humanities, and the headmaster was saying to my dad, just don't allow that because it's a complete waste, and she should just do engineering or something like that. So I think at least maybe, well, I want to think things are changing, but I don't think so much. But certainly for my generation, humanities or creative things like you're saying, we're a bit of a waste, I think.
But do you not have ethics in colegio? Do you not have like an ethics or philosophy class?
We do have philosophy, and some schools. When I was at school, everybody had religion, and now you can choose religion or ethics.
Okay. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. See, we didn't have anything like that.
Did you not have CSPE?
Yeah, that came in later on,
but
it was very, it was in its infancy at the time. It was brand new, SPHE, social, political.
Oh, health.
Yeah. But there was no critical thinking. Like, there was no critical thinking, you know, and I...
It's just a picture of, like, the Taoiseach. Like, who is this man?
Yeah.
The Taoiseach.
Exactly. I was like, okay, now I know who that is.
Yeah.
Like, just the kind of structures, the underlying structures of things is what I missed as well, and stuff like that. But, yeah.
You mentioned, how, like, you could combine things, language and something else, or football, and elevate it into something that's kind of a bigger story. Sid Lowe is very good at doing that. Like, he throws in Spanish phrases a lot. If you read The Guardian, Barney Arone, Marina Hyde, there's another guy, Daniel Taylor, tell the kind of bigger stories that's outside the football. They're very good at elevating it. And I just want to ask you as well, because in your book you do quote Mark Twain, reference Sid Lowe, and you give a nod to Giles Tremlett as well. And you mentioned the Irish journalists as well, and obviously we grew up with the mafia of, well, I mean in a good sense, because they're fantastic, of Eamon Dunphy, Johnny Giles, and Who was the presenter? Hurley.
Bill Hurley.
Bill Hurley, yeah. I mean, which were amazing. I mean, so weird that they're not there really anymore because they're such a part of our life. How do you see yourself as a writer, as a football journalist as well? Like, what kind of mark do you want to make? Because we mentioned before the interview that Sid Lowe is like the man in Spain for this kind of thing. And where, how do you see yourself now, and where do you want to go with this?
Yeah, like, to be honest, like, I don't see myself as any kind of a writer, to be honest with you, because I'm brand new to this, and I also wouldn't even consider myself a journalist because I'm not out there breaking news and things like that. And I guess with the invention of Twitter and social media, it's great because anyone can publish themselves now on a blog and you can write, but it also kind of and it breaks down certain barriers, but it also creates this kind of middle ground between journalists and writers and things like that. And you have people calling themselves journalists who aren't, like, you're, like, you know,
it's very common in football, I think, you know.
Yeah, especially with football. And that's the other thing, and that, like I said, if you're passionate about something, you can do it, but that also doesn't mean that you're qualified to do it yet, like, you know.
Yeah,
so, like, as I said, I'm just learning. And, like, to describe myself as a writer, I don't even have a style yet, and hopefully in maybe 10 years or so I will have that kind of voice. But, like, you see, for example, Sid Lowe. And I would be biased, in the fact that I listen to him most because I'm a Spanish football fan, and secondly because I've met him a couple of times. But I think Sid Lowe is absolutely brilliant. Like, his articles and his style of writing is so unique. And
yeah,
and they say, like that book, Copy Like an Artist or Steal Like an Artist or things like that. And I do tend to read, and I read, like, Jonathan Liu, I find really good with The Independent.
Yeah, because these guys are genuinely students of the game, you know. Like, they know things, and they're also cultural in a broader sense as well, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And brilliant writers, like, I mean, Jonathan Liu is so, like, literally laugh out loud some of his phrases. Like, and to be able to do that with words on a page is just, for me, is fascinating. And then you get like the reason I moved to America in the first place, because I love American sports. I don't know what my first love was, but American football is definitely up there. Like, I remember watching it. We got Sky Sports in 2000, and it was a February, and it was just a week before the Super Bowl, and I saw an ad for this American football, and I'm fascinated by the Midwest in America, that culture, Americana, that kind of music and that kind of whole thing. And I just fell in love with watching American football on a Sunday night. Like, my mates they laugh, like, because we'd always be hanging around with each other, but on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock, don't even try and contact Rob because he's gone. He's going to be watching American football. And I used to call, and I don't know why I did this, because I could read it online, but I used to go and buy the USA Today on a Monday and read the stats about the players. I don't know where that's from, but I just absolutely love American football. That was one of my first proper loves. So I read a lot of, like, and basketball writing, and, like, the likes of, like, David Halberstam wrote The Breaks of the Game. He followed around the Portland Trail Blazers for a year, and just one of the best books I've ever read.
Yeah, American sports writing is elevated into something that's more than the sport. It is like a whole another level of appreciating the sport. And have you ever seen the clips of American football on Irish television in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, my dad used to watch the William the Fridge Perry. The Bears, I'm a Bears fan, so William the Fridge Perry, they won it in 1985.
Yeah.
And it was the last time they won it. But it was on ITV or something, and my dad used to tell, like, when I first started, we used to watch it together the odd time. He didn't have a clue, really, but he'd be like, these lads now are going to score a touchdown, are they? Not that it can't, because whatever was happening.
Yeah, it was the same with the RTE coverage, and RTE is the Irish broadcaster, but, like, they had, like, people like Dickie Rock on the panel, or, like, Father Ted, Dermot Morrigan, and, like, they wouldn't have a clue. There's geez, the Fridge, what was his name, the Fridge Johnson?
The Fridge Perry.
The Fridge Perry's like, he's a bit like a fridge, he's a big fan, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just, like, complete mental.
Yeah,
you know?
And they know that. But
even, like, the coverage, because you mentioned Sky Sports, because my friends in university got into American football in a big way, and you just watch one match, and then picture in picture, and watching the other match, and just the way it's packaged and done is just very professional, very slick. And were you part of the Tim Tebow bandwagon back in the day as well?
Yeah, I was in Chicago for that, actually, and I did never really... I just kind of... I never really watched college football that much, but he was a legend with the Gators and things like that. And to be honest, I never really got into it. But that's when, and it was kind of like weird because I had culturally appropriated American football, but then then when I was in Chicago, I was in love with it, and I watched it, and I just could not get enough of it. And I used to win like bets with people because I used to work in a bar there. And I used to win bets with people because they're like, this Irish lad, no way he knows this. And the answer to this question. And I remember there's a kicker called Martin Gramatica, and just some kicker from years ago. And this lad, he thought he had me cornered. And he asked me a question, and I said, Martin Gramatica. And he could not fathom how this lad from Ireland, fresh off the boat, knew the answer to this question. I was like, no, I used to watch it religiously. It was the first thing I would say I ever became obsessed with. Anyway, I just absolutely loved it, and that's how I started. I used to read a lot of the articles then, and that would have been my first introduction to, because I wouldn't have read the papers when I was younger, like and things like that in Ireland. So I never really got into that, and it would have just been more about playing as opposed to reading about it. But I read about American football, then I kind of started watching NBA and things like that, and that would have been my introduction. And actually, my thesis in college was the difference between European sports writing and American sports writing, and that kind of, because it's more of a cultural phenomenon in America, and they kind of treat it as such, entertainment almost, whereas in Europe it's different. And I tried to get to the bottom of that, and I don't think I did very well in the end, but yeah. At least I was asking the question, like, you know.
Was it a capitalist thing?
I guess that's obviously part of it.
Yeah.
And it makes it more fair, the games. Like, there's more socialist systems, like the draft and salary caps.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's a strange thing about American football. You have that, which makes it very pure.
Yeah.
Like, in a way you don't have in football, for example, the difference between Real Madrid or an Eibar. But then they could move the franchise to Miami from Oklahoma or something like that, and then...
Yeah.
You don't have a team, you know?
Yeah, a lot of some of those 30 for 30 documentaries of Bill Simmons and that, there was just about teams moving. And it's just weird. They literally call them franchises, and it's just strange.
Yeah.
And you get that. So obviously there is that kind of capitalistic thing. But in terms of sports writing, I'm not really sure. But it would have started, I guess, with... what was the guy's name? I can't think of it. He wrote The Four Horsemen was the name of his... it was...
What, the Buccaneers? Or...
Grantland Rice. Do you know Grantland? Grantland, Bill Simmons' website. Grantland Rice was one of the first sports writers, and I guess that's how it started. And that would have been like there's a guy called Brian Curtis who I interviewed for the thesis, and he writes a media column for The Ringer, which is Bill Simmons' news site, and he speaks about that kind of golden age of sports writing. And then you get like Hunter S. Thompson, who went to the Kentucky Derby and wrote about that from a cultural standpoint, whereas you wouldn't have gotten that. You're kind of getting that more now when you get more kind of football magazines, culture magazines. You get like Mundial, The Blizzard with Jonathan Wilson and things like that. But there's also this kind of sanctity in terms of sports. There's only so much you can write about because you don't know. Whereas in the NBA and things, they write about what the coach was doing and what they think he was doing. Whereas there's this kind of... And media have way more access. So journalists go into the dressing room in the NBA and talk to players, and they're hanging around them. And the players understand that we need the media. And the journalists know that they're needed. So there's way more access. There's way more... And it's seen as more like you go to a baseball game. It's not do or die, which I don't like, but it's also more of a entertainment value. You go to a baseball game, it's more about the day out, as opposed to who's going to win. Whereas you go to Rio, okay, it's a day out, but it's also all that matters here is between those lines. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I understand, which is strange because Eamon Dunphy wrote a book called More Than a Game.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, we were not good players, or we didn't have a hope of doing anything, but as long as you leave everything on the pitch, there's like an honour in that, there's a value you give to your life. And
yeah,
personally, I find it hard to wrap my head around like that aspect, where maybe in baseball, it's not do or die, as you mentioned, and you just think, what's the point? But if it's just for fun with your friends, then fair enough. And maybe when they watch the NBA or the football, another part of the season, it is a bit more intense because...
But I guess you get the diehard fans.
Yeah.
And then you also get, I'd say maybe 70% or more are just there for entertainment value, whereas in soccer it's kind of maybe flipped, so 70 or 80% are there, maybe even more, 90%, 95% are there for my team. And then in, but in, that's what you get when they're franchises, when it's business. And you get players like, say, Kevin Durant this year in the NBA, he's leaving for more money, and there's no hostility towards him. It's a business, and they say that, which in a way is refreshing in that it's honest, but then, because it's like that in soccer, but then there's also this kind of thing where no, you, because clubs grow from the community, so there is that underlying identity you have, whereas say for example the Toronto Raptors literally was created as a as an expansion franchise in the I'm not entirely sure when, but like not that long ago. So they literally created, so you're just creating a business and you're asking people to have a link to that, and you have to create that link, whereas at Rio it's there. It's or any other team, it's there since 150 years ago, or sorry, 100 years ago.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, because you have that link already there. And speaking about Rio and Spanish football in general, we're going to see more and more the Copa del Rey in Morocco, or maybe in El Clasico in Saudi Arabia. And what they'll say is that this is for our fans globally. And of course, I do believe that they are passionate fans in other countries, of course, and would love to see those teams play. But what do you think of that phenomenon as well of having a Barca Madrid game in another continent?
Yeah, no, I guess like I have this discussion a lot with my editor, and he's just like, it's a global, or sorry, it's a local game. Football is a local game, and no matter how big it gets, which it seems to be increasing exponentially, but it's a local game. Nobody really cares about Real Betis.
Yeah.
Other than the people that are from there, and I don't think they ever truly will. And I know that's it's kind of a controversial subject, because someone in Miami or wherever, Chicago, Real Madrid fan since birth, are they
a real fan?
Any less, are they a real fan, or are they any less value to someone who's from there and who relates to that? I mean, as far as, and see, this is the thing, people say, well, you have to keep up with the Premier League, but you don't. Well, it depends on how you're looking at it. Are you looking at it from a business point of view? Because within a capitalistic system, it just has to be continuous growth, and it can never slow down, or else you're failing. Or are we looking at this as an organic football league that we want to make as competitive and as fun for the people who watch it?
Yeah.
And I guess if you're, like, there's this also, if you're not, like, if you're not growing, there's a certain amount of kind of entropy there, and you're losing market share and things like that.
Yeah.
But it depends on how you look at it. From a business point of view, yes, it has to go to Miami, but that can't be how you, and it is a struggle, like,
I think I think it depends on how you grow it, because you have like a lot of clubs like Madrid who don't want to play Spartak Moscow in the Champions League because they won't get a lot of TV money. And you think in that sense, well, tough luck, you know, because it's a football competition that everybody should have access to. And then you have people, the super clubs, who want to have maybe their own Super League, where it's like going to be PSG, United every second week, you know. But for me personally, I think that's going to be very boring. I want to see these like different matchups on a more, you know, on a regular basis, not just the same teams over and over again. I'm tired of seeing Arsenal play Barcelona, for example, which happened more organically, but still there'll be more of that in this kind of European league. And then you get these real fans who think, well, leave them go, football will be better when they're gone, and be more equal when it's going to be Stoke against West Brom in the Premier League, and Liverpool will be in this European competition, you know. But I just think the way they want to grow it is just so artificial and so against the ethics of the game, where it's just like, well, we are the big teams now, and we're going to stop other people competing with that. I mean, Ajax, they're a historic club, but I imagine there's a lot of big clubs who think, well, Ajax shouldn't be here. They don't have a right to be here.
Yeah.
And that's kind of their view of it, you know?
Yeah. And that's so important in that. It's kind of like, I was reading about celebrities in Hollywood. They have a new entrance and exit now for them in the airport. And they were saying, it's just literally class segregation, and they were like, and someone was joking on Twitter, they were like, and this was ages ago, and I was just, it's just, but you can translate it back to football, and someone was like, oh, next thing they're gonna have their own planet, like, like it's a joke, but it's true, like, that's not true, but it is. I mean, what I often wonder, teams, fans of teams that are running away with leagues and things like that, and I know that Real Madrid have to keep pace with Barcelona, and there's that rivalry, but I often wonder, like, what enjoyment do fans of super clubs get when they're playing the likes of Rayo and beating them 6-1? Is there any true enjoyment in that?
Well, because there's a question I wanted to ask you, which is almost like the flip of that as well, because in the book, obviously, you talk about the Rayo fans, and it's true that they want them to win, but mostly they want them just to give a good goal, give a good account of themselves. And you think, like, those small clubs who trade on heart and courage and that unity with their fan base, do you think conversely they could survive as a big club, and maybe deep down those fans don't want that to happen either, so you're kind of both ends of the table are kind of stuck in this kind of trap as well, maybe, you know, this kind of identity existential trap.
I guess so, but I mean that's all part and parcel of it. Obviously Rayo, if you were to tell me Rayo were going to win the league this year, I wouldn't have been like, no, we're not, listen, relegation battle is where we need to be, obviously. But I think corny or whatever, but the beauty is in the struggle, I think. Like,
true.
In everyday life, though, because if you, just for example, you were going to guarantee me happiness for the rest of my life, after a week, you'd be like, it's grand and all, but I need an obstacle. I need to, like that book by Ryan Holiday, The Obstacle is the Way. Like that, you have to overcome things, and that struggle on a weekly basis for me is, I suppose, that becomes a part of the club and becomes a part of the identity, and it becomes a part of why you love a club as well. But I know Real Madrid have their own obstacles in that. We want to win the Champions League, we want to consolidate. But I often wonder, like, if you were to eviscerate all the competition, like say Man City at the moment, not eviscerating them, but they're leaving a lot of clubs in their wake, at what point does it get not fun anymore? Like, what point do you be just like, okay, the challenge is gone here, what's next?
Yeah, and so there's such a contradiction there as well, because like Pep, I love Pep, but there's a feeling maybe he doesn't really appreciate the history of the club before the takeover, and the owners, even though they have been fantastic as well in investing in youth football and improving the area, on the other hand as well, you have the issue of kind of sports washing and image laundering as well. So, like, those kind of super clubs as well, apart from their dominance competitively, like, there's also these whole bucket of issues connected to that as well.
Yeah, and it's like PSG, they like, I think it's safe to say that they're not a laughing stock, but they're the kind of club that has become a little bit of a parody at the moment, like, in terms of some of the stuff that's going on with, like, getting knocked out of the Champions League in the weirdest ways, and just every single year just something happens, but they keep pumping money, and now Qatar are talking about pulling out the investment, and that becomes almost like the NFL. It's like you see teams like, I don't know if you read the book by James Montague, The Billionaires Club, Stan Kroenke, and he's saying, like, holding the fans to ransom, if you're not going to watch it, we're going to move. If you're not going to come and spend money in our stadium and watch it and that, we're going to move. And that's Qatar. They've no skin in the game.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like David McWilliams was speaking about in his book, his most recent book and podcast, about how foreign investment in Dublin, they just buy hotels and buy places, and then
straight out.
They have no skin. Like that book by Nicholas Nassim Taleb, Skin in the Game. Like, you can't trust people that have no skin in the game. Can't, like, because they've nothing to lose. And if they do start to lose, they're going to they're just going to withdraw, and that's what Qatar are doing at the moment. So how can you honestly feel linked to that? There's something not right there, and that you lose that with that kind of franchise ownership, things like that.
At least with City, there's an identity there. They want to pep, they want to promote young players. And we'll ask you just a few more questions before we leave you, enjoy your day, have a nice canyon on the terrace or something. We'll focus on Rayo as well. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, and again, this book talks about the identity, the history, and the current state of Rayo. And I ask you about the myth of Rayo, because I lived in Barcelona and I fell in love with the tiki-taka. Pep was there, Messi, Xavi, and Iniesta, and then I came home, and all the lads were like, "Ah, just take a jump," you know, kind of thing. And then, like, Madrid see themselves as the gentleman's club, but you know, then you have people like Pepe and before, and and kind of like now Ramos, and maybe not like the nicest characters, but and I mentioned as well. Well, I didn't mention it yet, but like Liverpool have this. This means more, and again, a lot of people have been ridiculing that. So, I mean, clubs do try and sell and project an image of themselves that are better than, or than reality, or it's based on reality, but it's also kind of commercialized. With Rayo, I think it's genuinely true. I think it is a real myth, and I guess you would too know that this is actually one of the few football myths that actually does hold up to scrutiny. That it's tangible.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the time, those identities are created with by marketers and things like this. So a lot of, like a lot of these TIFOs now, I was like, oh, look at that. I'm like, that was created by a graphic design team. And with the purpose of your jaw dropping. Like, that's not, there's nothing authentic about that. Whereas you see Rayo, the fans have painted it and there's paint dripping down those, you know, and it's just like, that's more authentic. And I think any kind of identity, any kind of a myth that is attached to Rayo is cultivated by the fans, as opposed to the club sitting around a table thinking, okay, what do we want to project? And I guess Raul Martin Presa does kind of cling on to that every now and again with certain initiatives and that, but people know that that's not, it's the fans, it's the club, it's the community. And so I think in terms of, yeah, I think that is Rayo. Like, I mean, that, yeah. And at what point, and I'm obviously party to this in that I wrote a book about them, so I'm drawing more not that many more people, but whoever did read it be like, oh, I like Rayo now. At what point am I complicit in making them a bigger club? And not me personally, but at what point, like, do you want to say, okay, that's enough now, like, we want to remain authentic? So I think, like, getting relegated and things like that, it's kind of like a cleansing experience, I guess, in that it kind of makes them more like the fans that were there previously are gone now, and it's more of an authentic kind of, right, let's start again from scratch.
I'll tell you one thing, I have a friend who is a Rayo fan since year dot. Well, he started off as a Real Madrid fan, but he thought the atmosphere was a lot better in Rayo.
Yeah.
A Spanish lad from Vallecas read your book, absolutely loved it. So for the diehard born in that situation, they truly value it, I think. Yeah. And then there's the last thing I want to say to you before we wrap it up, for example, regarding Rayo. Yeah, so you mentioned like a lot of characters, like there's a lot of personalities that stand out who like are also standing out in the community. And the last thing we can finish on maybe is the kind of personal dimension. There's a few anecdotes you share in the story, which I can identify with as well, because when I first came to Madrid, I had a friend who gave me a Rayo pin and also a scarf because she lived next to the stadium, and people would come over and talk to me and stop me, like you mentioned in the book as well. And even when you're in the stadium, I think you mentioned that the Rayo score a goal and somebody's celebrating with you, and like, we're doing this together kind of thing. So just to kind of finish on this kind of positive, very nice note, can you kind of just maybe like talk to us about your personal memories or of being a Rayo fan and interacting with the people who are from the barrio?
Yeah, like, and that's something that I noticed definitely, and something like the working class as Rayo and Vallecas would identify themselves as. The working class tend to be a lot less inhibited. They tend to be more less self-conscious about their, you know, and with that comes a certain kind of wit, you know. So you get loads of these stories going on the bus and like to different games, and some of the stories, just lovely people and having a beer and a coffee with them and things like that. So, and then like Paul Reedy, he's a Rayo fan, and there's a reason that you become a Rayo fan, I guess, and why you're drawn to the club. And I can see that with Paul, and that he's just an absolute gent and so nice. And we were playing soccer on Thursday, and we were walking by the pitch, and there was a guy wearing a Rayo jersey, and we were like, oh, there, look, the Rayo jersey, like two fools standing at the side of the pitch looking, smiling, this lad wearing a Rayo jersey, just because we felt some kind of a connection to him. And like, yeah, I just think that's wonderful, and it's something that I didn't have, because I would have grown up playing GAA, and that would have been my life, like, beyond, like, I was GAA mad.
Yeah.
And my family are still, and we still are. But But and that's how I would have. But it was. I guess it was different. It's different with fandom and European football fandom in that there's peñas and there's ultras and there's groups and things like that. And I go to games and it, as I said, as a novice and someone who go every time I step off the metro or I drive into the game and walk down, I'm like, this is absolutely incredible. Like it, and maybe someone from there wouldn't maybe appreciate it as much as a new thing. But for me, every single game is like walking out into the stand, and I'm like, this is just incredible how I could.
Yeah, I mean, those small stadiums are beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, Craven Cottage for Fulham, just like, and Turner's Cross for Cork City.
Yeah, yeah.
Just have a charm to them that,
you
just like obviously. Camp Nou and Burnaby are beautiful as well.
Yeah,
yeah. But you also mentioned in the book as well about how organised and socially active they are. We haven't had time to talk about that, but if you are interested, listener, you can find it on Amazon, no?
His
book. And are you working on anything else at the moment?
No, not at the moment, no, but I'm sure I'll let you know if I do have anything in the works.
Please do, a signed copy.
Yeah.
So, Robbie, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
No problem, guys.
Thank you. So that was our interview with Robbie. We hope you enjoyed it and enjoyed listening to his insights and thoughts on a variety of topics. And remember, you can listen to all our podcasts on Spotify, iTunes, Deezer, and many other platforms. And you can also find us on Instagram at elarpa and on Twitter at elarpa1 and on our Facebook page, elarpa media. And you can check out our blog, irislifeofmadrid.com, as well, where we will also be posting a blog version of this interview. And you have a lot of interviews to look forward to in the next couple of months, because we have a few surprises ready for you that we will be revealing in due course. So thank you so much for listening, and see you next week.
The Elarpa Podcast. The home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.